what we found was, you know, bears can clearly swim quite long distances.
A study documents epic polar bear swims. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 1st. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, thinking about the future of international diplomacy in the Arctic.
For the moment, the prevailing conditions in terms of the announcements that the countries have made and the actions they've taken are very cooperative.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it will hold off for at least a year on killing wolves on the Kenai Peninsula. The wolf kill plan was expected to help more moose survive. Division of Wildlife Conservation Acting Director Doug Vincent Lang says the department supports intensive management on the peninsula, but wants to establish a sound scientific foundation for any action taken. He says the department this year will study the best way to increase moose numbers. The Alaska Board of Game in January voted to extend predator control to two game units on the peninsula south of Anchorage. The board in recent years has taken an aggressive approach to killing wolves, black bears, and grizzly bears to boost moose and caribou numbers through liberal predator hunting and trapping seasons. A new study shows polar bears are swimming long distances as the Arctic Ocean sea ice retreats. The United States Geological Survey documents polar bears swimming for days with little or no rest on ice floes. But the study doesn't look at what cost these endurance swims have on the population as a whole, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Polar bears are good swimmers. They have large forelimbs that help them move through the water. But USGS researcher Anthony Pagano says it's been impressive to document just how good they are at swimming. He used GPS data from collared bears to study 50 long-distance swims between 2004 and 2009. The bears swam a long, long way.
The mean was about 95-mile long swims that these bears were taking.
The mean was how long?
95 miles.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Pagano documented one female bear in 2008 who swam 420 miles over 10 days. In that case, the swim came at a big cost.
She had a yearling cub with her the time that the collar was deployed, and she actually started swimming a couple weeks after that and went for this long swim. And then she went then actually followed the pack ice back down. This was all over the course of the fall, and she was recaptured then in that October, and she was missing her yearling cub, and she had lost, I believe it was about 20% of her body weight.
In all, 10 adult females in the study had cubs when their collars were deployed. When they were recaptured later, 6 still had their cubs. Pagano says researchers can't say if it was the long swims that caused the moms and cubs to separate. And he says overall, the study couldn't quantify how taxing the swims were for the bears.
Their movement rates, we found, were a lot higher than, you know, their movements when they're on the sea ice, presumably because, you know, they're not able to rest or to hunt when they're swimming, and they appear to be moving continuously when they're in the water. So presumably that might be affecting, you know, their body condition. They're expending higher amounts of energy, but whether or not that's affecting their survival or not, we don't know at this point.
The polar bears took their long swims between July and October, when the sea ice is at its minimum. The bears can't survive without the sea ice. They need it to hunt seals, their main food source. Biologists are trying to understand how sea ice loss is affecting the bears. And Pagano says the swimming study offers some insight into how polar bears are coping with their changing environment.
Generally, it shows that, you know, bears, you know, have an ability at least to move among this deteriorating sea ice habitat, which, you know, historically wasn't melting out quite as far and wasn't as an extensive retreat as it is, as it's occurring nowadays.
Pagano was speaking from Barrow, where he's finishing up the spring field season. He says they have captured about 80 bears so far this year, and they appear to be in good condition. In the last few weeks of the study, the researchers are darting the bears to take small biopsy samples without having to capture them. He says the relatively new technique is less invasive and could make it easier to determine survival rates and population estimates. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Today, a think tank issued a wake-up call about growing militarization of the Arctic. The Center for Climate and Energy Solutions released a report on the security implications of an Arctic ocean with less sea ice. The report documents a dramatic increase in policy actions by Arctic nations, many of them military. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
In a way, it really started getting serious 5 years ago in 2007. That was the year a Russian submarine put a small flag on the ocean floor at the North Pole. It was also the summer when the sea ice melted back farther than anyone had ever seen it before. This began a flurry of diplomatic actions, but also, says Center for Climate and Energy Solutions senior scientist Jay Gulledge, the beginnings of a military buildup.
For the moment, the prevailing conditions in terms of the announcements that the countries have made and the actions they've taken are very cooperative. That really is the prevalent theme right now, and that's encouraging. However, what's going on in a layer below that is that almost all of the Arctic countries are building modern military capabilities to operate in the Arctic that go far beyond just being able to police their local waters.
The report runs down those actions country by country. The eight Arctic nations, but also the European Union, China, Japan, and others. Most of it's been reported before, but when it's all added up, it's impressive. Russia put warships back in the Arctic Ocean in 2008. Denmark has been beefing up its navy with ice-capable vessels. Canada is building a deep-water port on Baffin Island and installing equipment to monitor all traffic through the Northwest Passage. Gulledge says it's time the eight Arctic nations had a place to talk about all this, and the best place for that is the already existing Arctic Council.
Basically, we're getting down to where it's time we've got to put really strong multilateral diplomatic tools in place to deal with these emerging militaries in the Arctic. And the Arctic Council has a ban on discussing military security issues, but it's the strongest and only full multilateral mechanism we have for dealing with the Arctic as a region. All of the Arctic countries are a member. It's a well-respected organization. And we, in our report, say that it's time for the Arctic Council to drop its ban so that they can talk about military issues.
The United States is behind the other Arctic nations in many areas. It shut down the ADAC naval base years ago, and it has just one functioning icebreaker. But last year, for the first time, a U.S. Secretary of State attended an Arctic Council meeting, and the Coast Guard began actively looking at sites for an Arctic deepwater port. And, of course, Shell Oil is ready to deploy an armada of drillships and support vessels to explore its Alaska offshore lease sites in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. Yesterday, Deputy Interior Secretary David Hayes and Arctic Research Commission Chairwoman Fran Ulmer led a workshop to encourage better communication between government managers and scientists about Arctic energy activities. Hayes says that communication has often been lacking.
Frankly, there's been a disconnect to some extent between the scientific community and the policymaking community. How can we make sure that the science that we're putting out there for Alaska and the Arctic in particular is answering questions that will help decision makers make good decisions?
Hayes is not ready to say what the final decision is going to be about Shell's drilling permits this summer, but he says he wants to make sure those who make the decision can get at all the science they need.
We're having a terrifically robust discussion with both communities. We're together more than we ever have been, and it's actually very exciting because everyone wants us, all of us, to make the right decisions, and an informed decision is going to be a better decision.
Hayes said the workshop included staffers from Governor Sean Parnell's office and Native organizations. The administration could issue more policy announcements on the Arctic tomorrow, when top State Department and Navy officials give speeches to the American Geophysical Union. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Homer couple rescues two cyclists on vacation in Hawaii.
We kind of got stuck when the clouds rolled in. We just weren't dressed appropriately, and we just weren't prepared for that weather.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Shelley Hughes has been appointed to serve out the term of the late Representative Carl Gatto. Governor Sean Parnell made the announcement Tuesday in Palmer. Hughes campaigned for Gatto in past elections and is the only one of the three nominated for the post who has filed with the Alaska Public Offices Commission, signaling her intent to run for Gatto's seat. District 13 Republicans had sent Parnell three names as potential appointees. The others are David Eastman and Marvin Yoder. House Republicans must still ratify Parnell's choice. This year's lower-than-expected herring harvest has renewed calls from the Sitka Tribe of Alaska to change the fishery. The tribe has long expressed worries about the amount of fish taken by the commercial fleet in the lucrative Sitka fishery. This year, fishermen caught only about half of what they were allowed. The tribe sees it as validation of a long-held concern, but a state biologist says although this year definitely requires some study, the model used to manage the fishery is still good. KCAW Ed Ronco reports.
Earlier this year, the Sitka Tribe of Alaska took out a series of ads in Southeast newspapers, all with a similar message, that they felt the state was letting commercial fishermen harvest too many herring. Managers set a limit for the commercial fleet at just under 29,000 tons this year. When all was said and done, the fleet captured about half that number. The reason? Quick spawning, said managers, and as it now turns out, a lower-than-expected return of herring in the first place. Fisheries managers predicted about 144,000 tons of fish would occupy Sitka Sound this year. The current estimate of what actually returned is around 99,000 tons. Fish and Game Management biologist Dave Gordon.
That we're well below the forecast, but the harvest itself is within the 20% harvest rate, which is important to us to stay within that, stay below that 20%, and certainly was important for industry that we did not exceed that 20% harvest rate.
But for Jeff Feldpouch, it comes down to a simple question.
Why are we fishing these fish when they're the cornerstone of the majority of the marine ecosystem?
Feldpouch is resource protection director for the Sitka tribe. This year's harvest, he says, was a source of both comfort and alarm. On one hand, he feels it adds merit to the tribe's concerns. On the other hand, neither the commercial fleet nor subsistence harvesters had their needs met this year.
You know, the ADF&G managers, they follow policy, and we have to change that policy. And that either goes through the Board of Fish process, through the legislature, through referendums or citizens' initiatives, or down the line through legal action if necessary.
Gordon, with the state, says the science behind the fishery is sound. The model is accepted by fisheries biologists up and down the coast, and he believes that this year was a one-off. The model has performed well, generally speaking, he says, but he adds that it cannot forecast the unexpected.
You know, we're dealing with natural populations that are subject to things like this happening, and again, you know, herring are well known to, you know, population to oscillate quite dramatically over short periods of time. Looks like something has happened with the Sitka Sound stock. What it is exactly, we don't know.
But they'll be looking at data throughout the summer and the fall, and an adjustment will likely have to be made for next year's fishery, he says. Exactly what that adjustment is will depend on the data that scientists review between now and then. Fish and Game recorded 55 nautical miles of spawn this year, which is down from last year. Still, Gordon says the population has been trending upward. What's responsible for this year's low return could be natural mortality from predators or illness, or the fish could have simply relocated. Of course, if that were the case, Gordon says they would have found spawn elsewhere. So there's more to learn yet, and not just in Sitka Sound. Spawn was also lower this year in Hoonah Sound. 5 nautical miles were spotted, down from 12 last year. Gordon says his team tries to manage the fishery conservatively and that they feel like they have. Conservative management is also on the mind of Andrew Tomes.
I think we're definitely concerned. You know, we're the Sitka Conservation Society, and therefore we're a bit conservative about how we use the natural resources. And I think that we definitely need to take a conservative approach to harvesting forage fish, herring, which is the base of the food chain.
Herring are food for salmon, sea lions, whales, and more. Tomes says his organization is keeping an eye on the issue, but not yet taking any official action.
We've got no problem with a herring fishery and using some of the fish from the herring population, but I think it needs to be done with utmost caution. And I think that this year was kind of a wake-up call that we need to really make sure that everything's in order and be very, very careful about this fishery.
And that brings us back to Feldpouch with Sitka's tribal government. The tribe successfully petitioned the Board of Fish this year to establish a subsistence-only zone in the waters just north of Sitka's downtown, but he acknowledges that if it wants to affect any sort of larger policy change, his organization is going to need the help of other groups. Gordon, meanwhile, urges patience.
It's a lot of samples that need to be worked up by the lab, and they won't be complete with that until the fall.
Once that data is available, Gordon says they'll take a look and get a much clearer picture of what those fish did this year and what it might mean for next. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The start of wildfire season has managers assessing resources to battle blazes across the West this summer. There's serious concern about air tanker support in the lower 48, but as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the aircraft shortage is not an issue in Alaska.
Experts say firefighters could be busy this year if the La Nina weather patterns that have generated so much snowpack this past winter transitions into an El Nino pattern, as predicted, later this summer. If so, State Forestry Division spokeswoman Maggie Rogers says Alaska's firefighting agencies will be ready with 4 air tankers on contract to help the grunts on the ground knock down wildfires.
In Alaska, we're fortunate for this fire season that we have on contract 2 air tankers, Convair 580s for the Alaska Division of Forestry, and then 2 CL-215 water scooping aircraft for LM Alaska Fire Service. And those are in Alaska for our fire season and the duration that we need them. So we don't have quite the competition for resources that they might be experiencing in the lower 48.
Rogers is referring to the shortage of air tankers that firefighting agencies in the states are trying to deal with right now. The U.S. Forest Service, the largest of those federal agencies, has only 11 aircraft under contract to help fight what appears likely to be another very active wildfire season, especially in the Southwest and Rocky Mountain regions. That's a quarter of the 44 tankers that the Forest Service had on contract 10 years ago. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell said in a Thursday teleconference that the agencies are trying to contract more tankers.
We have 11 of our large air tankers plus. We'll bring on probably another 3 this year through additional contracts, along with one very large air tanker that we also have on contract.
Rogers says firefighting agencies often share resources when they're needed elsewhere, and that Alaska's agencies may make their 4 tankers available for duties in the states when they're no longer needed here.
If we are out of fire season or out of needing them up here, we can share them with the lower 48.
The shortage of air tankers and the airworthiness of the remaining aircraft, which average 50 years old, has caused great concern among the firefighting community, as has the federal government's failure to respond to the problem. A bipartisan group of 4 U.S. senators last month called for a federal review of the situation, coming as it does in the face of increasingly severe fire seasons. The senators from 4 western states, including Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, urged the U.S. Government Accountability Office to come up with solutions to the problem as quickly as possible. The senators urged the GAO to study efforts to identify the number and type of aircraft needed and to determine whether decision makers have considered all available options. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
For the last 15 years, Robert Crowley has been a kind of year-round Santa Claus to the South Central and Western Alaska ports that have relied on him as captain of the ferry Tustamina. After 36 years with the Alaska Marine Highway System, Crowley is retiring. Crowley disembarked in Homer this morning, completing his career with the Trusty Tusty in the same place it began in May of 1976.
When I was camping on Homer Spit and the ship came in and I said, that's the ship I want to work on. It wasn't to go to work for the Marine Highway System, it was to work on this ship. So I guess I've satisfied that dream, and the more I think about it, the tougher it gets.
When he was 15, Crowley started coming to Alaska to work on small freight vessels and landing craft. Over the years, he'd run into former bosses who'd gone to work for the Alaska Marine Highway System, and they'd encourage him to apply.
One of my bosses was unable to hire me back one spring, and the ship, like I say, I was on Homer Spit, and the ship came in, and I wandered over and said, how do I go about getting a job? And I went to Seward, and about a month later, I got hired.
Though he spent a few short hitches on other Alaska ferries, the Tustamina has always been Crowley's main assignment. He hinted that the fast and easy money that came with pipeline days in the late 70s was tempting, but he stayed with the ferry, which he says has brought a different kind of economic benefit to Alaska. He's excited about the two new Kodiak area ports the Tusty is serving, Ozinki and Old Harbor.
For the last 30 years or so, heading out west and adding ports as we go, it's changed quite a few communities, made them a little more vibrant, I think.
Crowley says he's a little bit nervous about retirement, but is otherwise looking forward to the future. This summer, he will relocate with his family to his wife's home, country of Scotland. When a Florida couple found themselves in a desperate situation after a bicycle ride up a Hawaiian volcano turned bad in a hurry, the last thing they probably expected was to be rescued by a couple from Homer, Alaska. But as KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, that's exactly what happened.
John Josephs is not exactly a newbie when it comes to fitness and cycling. He's an ex-Marine who owns Kona Human Performance, a company dedicated to physical fitness and athletic coaching. Josephs is a personal trainer himself, as well as a certified coach for USA Cycling and a two-time finisher of the Hawaii Ironman Triathlon. He and his wife, Tara, are avid cyclists and often take cycling adventure vacations in places like the Rocky Mountains and the French Alps. Earlier this month, the Jacksonville, Florida couple traveled to Hawaii, where they planned to celebrate their 10th wedding anniversary by renewing their vows. On April 10th, in the tiny town of Paia on the northwest coast of Maui, the Josephs rented a pair of bicycles and set out on another adventure, an 80-mile round-trip ride up and down the windy road to the summit of Haleakala, a 10,000-foot-tall volcano that looms large over the entire island of Maui.
Haleakala was on my bucket list.
And the climb up Haleakala was nice, at first.
But we kind of got stuck when the clouds rolled in. We just weren't dressed appropriately, and we just weren't prepared for that weather. So it just kind of all, everything came crashing down on us.
John and Tara were in good enough shape to take a triumphant photo of themselves kissing at the summit of Haleakala. But John says that about 10 miles into their 40-mile return trip down the mountain, when his body started to shiver violently, he knew they were in serious trouble.
And that's when your body temperature starts to drop to around 90 degrees, and it's just kind of uncontrolled total body spasms. I mean, your body's just trying to maintain body heat. And I think that's when I knew I crossed the line and I was going to have to do something because we weren't going to make it to the bottom.
We came around one of the left-hand turns, and they were both stopped on the right-hand side in a very dangerous part of the turn, and she was raising her arm to wave for us. So I pulled in and got out and talked to them, and she was trying to say, call 911, but she couldn't get it out. She was mumbling. She couldn't. They were so cold that they weren't speaking coherently.
That's Homer pilot Greg Martin, who was in Maui on vacation with his wife, Cinda. The Martins just happened to be traveling along the narrow two-lane road to Haleakala when they saw the Josephs trying to flag down some help. Greg Martin says he could see from the gray color of Tara Joseph's skin that she was in pretty bad shape. As he and John Josephs loaded the bicycles into the trunk of the Martins' rented Ford Crown Victoria, Cinda tended to Tara in the back seat.
We just kept piling the coats on her. And Greg really was good about talking her through. Now, try to take deep breaths and try to, and he was just trying to talk her through it. And she did good. She did better.
As they all headed back down to the town of Paia, Tara and John's condition began to stabilize. John Joseph says Tara recovered pretty quickly once her body temperature returned to normal. And thanks to Greg and Cinda Martin, they were able to enjoy the rest of their vacation. The Martins are glad they were in the right place at the right time and were able to help the Josephs, but they declined the hero tag. They say all they were doing was following the Alaska way of stopping to help people in need.
They needed help, we gave them a ride. It's not like, oh, well, we'll leave a message for somebody when we get down the hill. I mean, that isn't going to work, you know?
And it was no big deal. I mean,
we just gave them a ride.
On our end, it really wasn't a big deal.
But it was definitely a big deal to John Josephs. The sad part, he says, is the fact that five or six vehicles passed them as they waved their arms desperately and pleaded for help before the Martins finally came along.
I just want to say thank you to Greg and Cinda Martin. I mean, they were just wonderful, and I want to thank them for helping us out, and the people of Homer, Alaska should be very proud of them.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Delta, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.